the Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
My thanks to great listeners who support this podcast, and we name names: Don Cisney, Gail, you know who you are, Stuart J. Smith, and our own Hearst Foundation, Gillian Hearst. If you're able and so inclined, you can contribute at my website or take out a voluntary subscription for as little as $5 a month. It's at peterbcollins.com. Today, another installment in the Boiling Frogs interview series and a continuation of our special coverage of 9/11. Today, the first portion of a three-part series with Paul Thompson, who published the 9/11 timeline and has done an amazing job of digging into some of the deep history of U.S. covert operations and covert operators. And you've got to listen as Sybil Edmonds reveals what happened when she asked Richard Clark to testify before a congressional committee. Listen carefully. This is a powerful, powerful piece here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the days are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Everybody knows, but do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secret privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sybil Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. Our guest today is Paul Thompson. He's the author of The Terror Timeline. He is an graduate of Stanford University, and he has been researching 9/11 and related issues for many years. Paul Thompson, welcome to the Boiling Frogs.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I just wanted to mention, as we delve into the complex issues of the events of September 11th, 2001, that there were two key bits that prompted me to become skeptical and curious and follow your lead in many respects to question the official story and seek the truth about 9/11. The first was when a friend who is a medical doctor and a private pilot came to me and talked to me about the disconnect between the Federal Aviation Agency and NORAD on 9/11. We may get into those details, but suffice to say, it was a sad comedy of errors, and it piqued my interest. But it wasn't until I saw the timelines that were developed by people like you, and there were some others who did similar work, that really showed the glaring inconsistencies in the official narrative and led to ask questions about the role of some of the individuals in the Bush administration and the level of honesty or lack of it that we have had to encounter including the way the 9/11 Commission was used to firm up the myth that had been launched right after the 9/11 attacks. Now, Paul Thompson, in recent weeks, Richard Clark, who was a key counterterrorism advisor to George W. Bush in the Bush White House, was the subject of an interview that was actually conducted a couple of years ago, but was broadcast on a public television station in Colorado. And it includes some very interesting new allegations from Clark, essentially that he was kept in the dark on one specific piece of information regarding two of the individuals who were later alleged to have been hijackers on 9/11. Why don't you recap for our listeners what Clark said and why it makes news about these issues?
Well, I recommend people go check out the interview with Clark for themselves. It's at secrecykills.com, and that's about 12 minutes long, so it's not too much information to take in, and I think the whole thing is very interesting. But in short, you know, he was the counterterrorism czar at the time of 9/11 and for a few years before that, and that means he was the highest counterterrorism official in the United States. So he really was the top dog, and all information, all important information, was supposed to come through him to get to his desk. And so in this interview, he says, you know, there are these two hijackers, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midar, and it looks now, in retrospect, that for a long time, people in the CIA knew a lot about those guys, those two hijackers, and that information did not come across my desk. He says he was in contact with Tenet, talking to him on the phone 3-4 times a day. Anytime there was any little bit of information, he would get a phone call from Tenet. He was receiving, you know, over 100 CIA reports a day and looking them over. There was a steady flow of information. And, you know, it's hard to think before 9/11, what would be a bigger red flag than having two known al-Qaeda operatives actually inside the United States? And yet for all of this time, nobody told him that, he claims. And so he's quite shocked about this and quite dismayed, and he ends up coming up with a theory to explain why that happened.
And his theory essentially is that the CIA was trying to work with these two Saudis and convert them to CIA assets. And in order to flip them, they kept this very tightly held. The other theory that surfaces for me, though, Paul, is that, as you mentioned, Richard Clark had served in the Clinton administration and was a holdover into the Bush White House, one of the few.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense is that he was not entrusted with the darkest secrets of the Republican inner circle that arrived determined to attack Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, I think to some extent that's true. He was certainly kind of demoted, allowed to keep his job, but sort of not in the inner circle. He wasn't meeting with the principals anymore, meaning cabinet-level people, like he had been in the Clinton administration. But you have to remember also that George Tenet was a holdover from the Clinton administration, and he was the head of the CIA all the way back to 1997. And this is really a lot about Tenet and the CIA hiding this information. So you got two Clinton holdovers, really, who are at the center of this.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, he was privy to some of this stuff that the Bush administration was doing. Like, I had heard this interview with Richard Clark, and I was driving down the road, and I practically drove off the road. I was so shocked. This was a few years ago, where he mentioned in an interview with NPR Radio that around, I think it was around April, May 2001, basically top Bush people were sitting around a table and discussing ways to have some kind of provocation to go to war with Iraq. And they were kind of brainstorming different ideas on ways to have a casus belli, you know, some sort of excuse for the war. And they talked about things like flying an airplane over Iraq and making sure that it got shot down by the Iraqi forces so they could use that as a, you know, as an excuse. So, I mean, that's some pretty wild stuff that most of the American public has never heard about.
That particular idea that was floated by apparently George W. Bush was in a conversation with Tony Blair, and it was British, I believe, Sir David Manning, the British ambassador to Washington, who ultimately revealed that. And it does show that they were looking for a pretext, and possibly it wasn't the first one that they had thought about or activated.
Right.
So, Paul, as we heard this interview with Richard Clark, many other questions come up, because he does make a very precise allegation, which is that on September 4th of 2001, there was a principals meeting in the White House, and he was not told, the principals were not told, that the CIA had informed the FBI about the presence in the United States of Al-Hazmi and Al-Midhar. And he says, if they had told us, we would have found those assholes. And he talks about what they would have done, first launching an investigation into malfeasance by the CIA for not sharing this information, and secondly, that he said we would have put it out on the Associated Press and found those guys.
Well, I'd kind of like to go all the way back to the beginning and talk about the whole story of these two guys. I think their story has not really been understood or appreciated by the American people as the importance that it really needs to have. But to just kind of mention a little bit about what you were saying, that very day that that meeting happened, which was September 4th, 1 week before the 9/11 attacks, there's a very strange mystery, because there was in a couple weeks right before 9/11, there was some information about these two hijackers that was finally given to the FBI after the CIA had known about these guys for 2 years. And there was this very inexperienced FBI agent by the name of Robert Fuller who was given the job of finding these two hijackers. The hijackers, these two guys, were not living undercover, using aliases, you know, using all kinds of clever spy tactics. They were living completely openly in the United States. One of them even had his name in the San Diego phone book, for crying out loud. They had bank accounts, they had credit cards, they had car registration, they had traffic tickets, they just all down the line, everything in their own name. So at that time, the United States had developed over the years a lot of databases. For instance, you could look up a police database that would have anybody's traffic tickets or arrests listed in there, and Al-Hazmi had been actually arrested a couple times for minor things. You can look up credit check. You can look up the motor vehicle index. They have all these great sort of private companies collecting incredible amounts of information about people, like Choice Point was one of these. They had the hijackers' names and addresses in that. So he had all these databases to look at, something like 10 different databases, and supposedly he didn't find the names of these two hijackers in any of the databases, which just doesn't make any sense at all. Immediately after 9/11, other people did checks, and they found these names in pretty much all these databases. And interestingly enough, we have a mention that says that he asked permission from someone else, from a higher-up, to search the credit card database for the names of these two people, and he was told that was not advisable, not prudent to do so at this time. So you can see there's something very strange going on there. Why on earth would they not want to be looking at databases to see if these people were in the United States? What would be the possible excuse to be telling this agent not to do that? So I would like to go all the way back to the beginning and kind of tell the whole story about these two hijackers.
Well, go right ahead. We are all ears. So, how far back would you like to go?
I want to go all the way way back. I think another really great untold story is, which I have to sort of give the highlights of, is how much the United States intelligence community knew about Al-Qaeda before 9/11. I just want to mention something that I found. It was from a report about 6 months after 9/11 that shows just how jaw-dropping this was. And this is from a Washington Post article that talked about the capture of Abu Zubaydah, who's supposedly Al-Qaeda bigwig, and he was arrested in early 2002. And I'll quote from the article, quote, "When agents found Zubaydah's laptop computer, a senior law enforcement source said, they discovered that the vast majority of people he'd been communicating with were being monitored under FISA warrants or international spying efforts. Quote, finally we got some comfort, unquote, that surveillance efforts were working, said a government official familiar with Zubaydah's arrest." So this is quite remarkable, because there's been a lot of controversy about Zubaydah. Was he really some important Al-Qaeda guy or not? Some people think he was mentally ill, but there's no doubt that he was sort of like a travel agent, and he was in communication with a vast number of people. There, one of the people who says that he was kind of crazy and not as important as people say, an FBI agent by the name of Dan Coleman, he said that even though he was crazy, he was constantly on the telephone talking to people all around the world. He was kind of being used perhaps as someone who is expendable if they got caught, because he did have these mental issues. So all around the world, all these Al-Qaeda operatives, we find that the vast majority of them were actually under surveillance at this time, just a short time after 9/11. So to me, that's a story that's never been told. How is it that Al-Qaeda has been able to operate as successfully as they were when they were being monitored so closely?
Well, that's a lingering question that we're going to have to deal with. So take us back to when Al-Hazmi and Al-Midhar first became evident, or we first became aware of them as we look back forensically.
Right. Well, I think we have to go even further back than that. If you go all the way back to the early 1990s, you have Osama bin Laden's living in Sudan rather openly. And we know that way back then, the U.S. intelligence community already started monitoring his satellite phone. And in fact, according to one report, even way back then, they developed the technology that they got enough of his vocal recognition so that if he called on any telephone, they would be able to go through their incredible NSA database and match that phone call with his voice. So he didn't even have to be using his phone. Any voice, they'd be able to figure out that was a Osama bin Laden call. And so he's living there, and around 2006, this other Al-Qaeda operative, who's a longtime close personal friend of Osama bin Laden, starts this hub in Yemen. And this is going to play a very important role in the story of Al-Hazmi and Al-Midhar. And what was happening was that a lot of the countries where Al-Qaeda was operating, like Afghanistan, Egypt, Somalia, different countries, the governments there, they were trying to prevent phone calls being made by militants from one country to another. So, for instance, Egypt didn't allow anybody in Egypt to call Afghanistan. They would block all those calls if they could. There was a lot of these blockages. So what a lot of the Al-Qaeda operatives around the world did was they used this Yemen hub as basically an Al-Qaeda switchboard. They would call that hub and say, I'm looking for so-and-so somewhere in my friends over in Europe, and, you know, connect me with that person. So this was just of incredible importance, this hub. Osama bin Laden himself called the hub many, many times. And what happened was that the NSA, the FBI, the CIA, they all realized the great importance of this hub, so much so that they not only monitored the phone calls from the hub, but they actually physically planted bugs inside the building, and they even had a satellite in the sky that was dedicated to the hub that would take satellite photos of anybody coming and going from the building. And this goes way back to the 1990s when they were doing this. And the what they also did was they had a big map of the world that they put on the wall somewhere, some FBI agents, and every time there would be a call from that hub to somewhere in the world, they would put a pin in the location of that where that call was going. And so over time, they were able to map Al-Qaeda's operations all around the world. And so you can start to see why, from this Washington Post article, they were able to say that they had the vast majority of all Al-Qaeda operatives around the world under surveillance. It was mostly because of this hub. So then, now let's get to the Al-Hazmi and Al-Madar part of this. It turns out that the person who owned this building and ran that hub was actually the father-in-law of Khalid Al-Madar, one of the hijackers. And so Khalid Al-Madar lived in the hub. His wife lived in the hub. Of course, he would be off doing various operations, but he would come back from time to time, visit his wife and his extended family, which was all pretty much living in that hub. And everybody in that family was pretty much Al-Qaeda. One report says that practically half of all the really dangerous operatives in Yemen were all related to this one family. So this is just like a laser being shown on this hub, on these phone calls and people in the hub. It just couldn't be any more important. And then at the end of all through 1999, Khalid Al-Madar was coming and going. The NSA was recording phone calls, the fact that he was living there. They got his name. They got the name of his good friend Nawaf al-Hazmi. And then it reached a climax at the end of 2009 when there was a series of phone calls. Basically, another high-ranking Al-Qaeda leader named Khalid bin Attash called up at the hub, called Khalid Al-Madar there and said, there's an important meeting coming up in Malaysia. We want you to attend. And he said, okay. And there was also a call to Nawaf al-Hazmi saying the same thing, come to the meeting in Malaysia. And there was a call also to Salem al-Hazmi, Nawaf's brother, who's another 9/11 hijacker. He's also told to come to the meeting. All of these calls are all being recorded by the NSA. And so they realize with the other U.S. intelligence agencies, something really important is happening in Malaysia. Let's track these guys to the meeting, record the meeting, find out what's going on there. And that's exactly what they do. On the way to the meeting, Khalid Al-Madar stops by in Dubai in the Middle East, and his passport is photographed secretly. Might have been by some local people there, might have been some people breaking into his hotel room and photographing it. But for whatever reason, they got his passport, and it revealed that he had a visa to come to the United States. And this is huge. You can't get any more important information than that, because they'd never really had any solid link of Al-Qaeda doing something, planning some kind of attack in the United States. This was the first really big break. So this brings us all the way up to the Malaysia summit.
And before we go there, Paul, can I just ask you a couple of things about this hub in Yemen? Because Michael Feuer, who was heading the Alex station, that was the Al-Qaeda desk, and it was named for his son Alec, he told me, and I believe he also told James Bamford, that he tried to get the NSA to share transcripts of these intercepted satellite phone calls that were coming into the hub in Sana'a in Yemen, and that the NSA refused. And apparently CIA was able to get one portion of the call. Let's just say it's the part originating from Yemen going up to the bird. And he even made a transcript of the one side of the call that CIA was able to intercept, sent it over to NSA and said, well, now, will you please give us the rest of it? And they declined. So some of this infighting between intelligence agencies on the U.S. side is of interest to me because it once again suggests, as Richard Clark has, that the top CIA officials were keeping some information about key al-Qaeda operatives very, very tightly held.
Right. Well, I'd say that sort of the main explanation that people give when they talk about this kind of thing is they talk about the infighting between these various agencies, and isn't it a shame that there was so much infighting, and that's really what prevented U.S. intelligence from stopping the 9/11 attacks. And certainly there was a tremendous amount of infighting that was going on. And what Richard Clark says is that the infighting excuse is not enough. It wasn't simply that FBI and CIA couldn't play ball together and so forth, there is such an egregious amount of hiding of information about these two hijackers that alone doesn't explain it. And I think that's what I'm going to try to argue here as we go along, is that, yes, there was this infighting, but that alone does not explain what's going on here. And certainly with the Yemen hub, there's tremendous amount of hoarding of information. The NSA hardly shared anything that they were getting about this. So what's interesting is that all three of those agencies, NSA, CIA, FBI, they realized how important this hub was, and they pretty much independently created their own ways of getting the information about the hub so they wouldn't have to rely on the other agencies. I think the CIA actually went so far as to build their own satellite antenna in the Indian Ocean so that they could get the information from this hub. So we'll follow that about the not sharing of information, but we have to be mindful that in a way that doesn't really apply to a lot of these things because they were gathering in their own information independently of each other.
And I think I may have misstated his name. It was Scheuer, Michael Scheuer, S-C-H-E-U-E-R. Okay, so with that said, continue your narrative and let's go to Malaysia.
I also like to point out that Scheuer, he left the CIA bin Laden unit in the middle of 1999, so he's not really privy to what happens afterwards, which is we're getting at the very end of 99, so they've tracked these two people, Al-Hazmi and Al-Midar, to the Malaysia summit. It's not really clear if the Salem Al-Hazmi ever attended or not, although he did go on to participate in the 9/11 attacks. And Malaysia was a great place to meet because the Malaysian government, wanting to be friendly with Middle Eastern governments, didn't even require a visa from most countries to come to that country, so people could just drift in very easily. And what seems to have happened was it was kind of like an al-Qaeda all-star team arrived at this summit. And there's some dispute over exactly who attended, and I think there's been a deliberate obfuscation all the way until today about just who was at that meeting. But I believe that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the 9/11 mastermind, quote-unquote, was at that summit. There's a lot of newspaper reports to that effect, and recently I came across some WikiLeaks documents that came out that indicated that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed lived for a whole week with Al-Hazmi and Al-Midar in Malaysia at that time, which would seem to confirm that he was there. Then you've got Hambali, who's sort of Al-Qaeda's biggest man in Southeast Asia. He worked with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed on the Bajinka plot in 1995, which was kind of an early version of the 9/11 attacks, which could have killed up to 4,000 people. Very major terrorist. He was known to be a major terrorist by the time of the summit. Then you've got Ramzi Bin al-Shib. Now, he's a very interesting case because he was a member of the Hamburg cell with Mohammed Atta and some of the other 9/11 pilots who seem to have come to this summit. German intelligence says they have credit cards of him being in Malaysia at the time. There were photographs of him taken at the summit. So that's a big what if. How is it that he goes to the summit and that doesn't somehow lead to the Hamburg cell in Germany being wrapped up. If this, you know, because the summit is being very heavily monitored by intelligence agencies. We'll get back to that. But anyway, so then you've got him. You've got Al-Hazmin Al-Midar. The host of the summit is a person named Yazid Sufat, who's seemingly head of Al-Qaeda's biological weapons program. It's being held in his apartment. You've got Khalid bin Attash, who's major operational planner. You've got another guy named Al-Nashiri, major operational planner. About a dozen guys in all. Very, very important. I don't think there was probably ever a time before 9/11 where there was such a collection of individuals outside of Afghanistan. It was just an unparalleled intelligence opportunity. So all these guys are gathering at this apartment of this Yazid Sufat. And what the CIA did, apparently, was instead of monitoring these summit attendees themselves, they had the Malaysian special branch, their intelligence agency in Malaysia, do the monitoring. And so the Malaysian special branch took photographs. On the first day, they actually recorded a lot of video footage. But the story is that they never got into the apartment where the summit was held. They never had any audio recordings. They were only taking pictures of these people as they wandered around town. They were staying at hotels. They were going to restaurants, visiting internet cafes, so on and so on. But they never actually knew what was going on in the summit. Now, I don't know if I believe that, but be that as it may, so you've got this recording of all this going on, and at the time it was considered so important that people at the cabinet level in the United States were being updated on a daily basis. The head of the FBI, George Tenet, head of the CIA, National Security Advisor. It doesn't seem it actually got all the way up to the level of Clinton, President Clinton, but certainly very top level people were being told on a daily basis as this summit went on. It was a four-day meeting. Every day they would be getting updates of what was happening at that summit. And another very important point is that this is at the very time where fear about Al-Qaeda was hitting a peak, because this summit just happened a few days after this January 1st, 2000, and there was a great fear that there would be millennium attacks to be timed with the start of the new millennium. And there had been an Al-Qaeda operative captured as he tried to enter the U.S. in Seattle just a couple weeks before. And so there was this great fear that Al-Qaeda might be planning some attacks to happen very soon in the United States. So you have this incredible worry and focus, and you have all these Al-Qaeda bigwigs all meeting right there in Yemen. So you would think that after all that, two of the 9/11 hijackers attending, the 9/11 mastermind attending, how is it possible that they don't just wrap up the whole 9/11 plot based on the surveillance of the summit? That's one of the big mysteries that's never been explained.
And so without asking you to form some hardened conclusion, as you recite these things, is it your suspicion that the Bush administration allowed it to happen, or was in some way involved in orchestrating it with these characters that they certainly had under surveillance?
Well, you know, I don't like to speculate along those lines. I don't even think speculation is necessary, because I think as we go into more details of this Malaysia summit and these hijackers and so forth, you can put forth three theories. You can say there was some sort of incompetence, people dropped the ball, that there was an Al-Qaeda operation going forward and the Bush administration let it happen, or that they actually helped make it happen. But I think the least worst of those would be the incompetence, obviously. But when you really look at this, it would have to be such a level of incompetence where you just have this right in your face over and over and over again, that would have to be criminal incompetence, which should lead to jail terms, in my opinion. So you're kind of, those different theories, it's almost a moot point where you're kind of arguing just how long do these people go to jail, you know? I kind of put it, I like to think of it in terms of a bank robbery, where you could think, okay, you could have a person standing there as a security guard, and the bank robber runs down the street, runs into the bank. So what is the security guard's role? He could be working to help the person, rob the bank. It could be part of the team, or he could be just letting it happen because he wants to see that bank robbed for whatever reason. Or he could just be totally incompetent and just stand there and do nothing while a massive amount of time goes by and the bank gets robbed. And that's just as bad as the other two, pretty much. I mean, wouldn't that bank robber be locked up? I mean, the security guard be locked up for a long time if he just, like, waited an hour knowing that the bank is being robbed and he didn't do anything about it, didn't tell anybody about it? To me, it's just as bad, really.
Mm-hmm.
So I see that as kind of, you can't really go inside these people's heads. We don't have enough data to really know everything, but we know enough that I think if there were to be, to this actually come to the courts, to the U.S. courts, that people would go to jail for something, because there's no good excuse for why these various attacks are allowed to go forward.
Well, actually, it even gets more confusing and complex than that, and that's the fact that both the CIA and the State Department, because a lot of these operatives at the CIA, they work under State Department titles, and starting from 1995, 1996, these same actors were working with, back then they were not called Al-Qaeda, at least not by the FBI's definition or the wiretaps collected between foreign targets and the State Department, but the same actors that we are talking about, our government people within the State Department and the CIA, and this is during the Clinton years, were working with these people in Chechnya, in the Balkans, in the Central Asia and Caucasus. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about working together.
Right.
Okay, well, so the question that comes up is, they are partners. They were our partners in the Balkans, you know, with the conflict in Bosnia and also in Kosovo. They were our partners with what we did with Chechnya, with Russia. They were our partners with some of the assassinations and the plots we were carrying out in places like Azerbaijan. The same people, Bin Laden, Zawahiri, even some of the actors involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we were also monitoring them as terrorists, but we were actually working with them.
Yeah, so it's kind of crazy when you think about it. I mean, I think that if you really start looking at the Machiavellian workings of what the U.S. government and other governments were doing, they kind of saw things in terms of quote-unquote good terrorists and bad terrorists, where you have terrorists who, for whatever reason, they thought these people are somehow doing our bidding. They're helping us out. They're helping us achieve our goals, either wittingly or unwittingly. A good example would be Chechnya, where, you know, for a long time, the U.S. had a great quagmire in Vietnam, and they like to sort of think of Chechnya as Russia's Vietnam, that this is a big quagmire for them. They've got to be dealing with these Islamist militants and fighting there constantly year after year. It's sapping their economy. They're a traditional enemy of the United States, so the more Chechnya can sap them, the more the American foreign policy experts are and officials are saying, hey, this is a really good thing. So why would we want to stop any potential Islamist militant from going to Chechnya and fight there? Hey, instead of stopping them, let's pretty much give them a plane ticket and have them go there, because that's helping us out, right?
Exactly.
And,
right.
And so that's not just with Chechnya, but that happened in a lot of other places around the world. So you have this idea where one man's terrorist is another man's or another person's freedom fighter, right? It's all these labels you throw on these people that are these very loaded words. You know, I try not to use words like terrorists if I can, because, you know, you never know exactly, you know, who really these people are, who they're working for, and really what's going on there. It often turns out there's double agents and all kinds of intrigue going on, like some sort of, you know, exciting spy novel. So, but anyway, so you've got these good terrorists, you've got these bad terrorists, and it's clear to me that there were a lot of people before 9/11 who were quote unquote good terrorists in the eyes of the United States, because they were doing something that the United States thought was helpful. In fact, there's a famous quote by Zbigniew Brzezinski, if I can get his name right, who's a national security advisor way back under Carter. And he was asked in 1998 about starting the whole war in Afghanistan way back in the 1970s, because really it looks now that the CIA kind of goaded the Soviets into attacking by putting some operatives in there and kind of stirring people up, creating a lot of chaos. So he said, let's see if I can find his quote here, what he said. I can't find his exact quote offhand, but it was something to the effect of, what's more important, defeating the Soviet Union or a few stirred up Muslims? So the idea is that he's in a very Machiavellian way thinking that I'm using these people to get at the Soviets and to achieve our foreign policy goals. And so we certainly don't want to stop these people. We actually want to help them, fund them, train them in some cases.
Exactly.
And it, you know, and we could go way back and look at a long history of U.S. covert support for Islamist militants around
and
the world.
Right, and let's say just in 1990s, starting from mid-1990s till 2000, and we are talking about during the Clinton administration, and we are talking about the two guys who are left over from that administration. We are talking about Tenet, and we are talking about Clark. And Tenet and Clark were also aware, not only aware, they were involved, both through the diplomatic working through State Department, but also through these black ops and operations in Central Asia, in Balkans, the Balkans. So we had those two guys involved in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and these
and
two particular people, Al-Hazmi and Al-Midar, they have a very long history of working with Al-Qaeda, and it goes all the way back to the Bosnian conflict in the early 1990s.
That's
it appears they were involved in that. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed also appears to have fought in Bosnia in the early 1990s. And then it appears that later on that they made an attempt at least and probably went to fight in Chechnya as well, these two, Al-Hazmi and Al-Midar.
Uh-huh.
So it could be that they might have had linkages. You know, there's a whole other story about U.S. support working with Al-Qaeda in Bosnia.
They were not even called Al-Qaeda. At least not in the FBI. This is one of the things I kept emphasizing during my testimony with the 9/11 Commission. The Arabic units that worked, and that includes the bombing in Nairobi, because some of the translators with FBI agents actually went in there. So I'm not going to get into the details of those, but they did not even emphasize the title, the name Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the interesting thing from the FBI side.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Al-Qaeda did not, even though we have this stuff, Al-Qaeda, and it came up again in 1997, FBI didn't even have an Al-Qaeda unit. And these cases, the filing for these cases, were not even under Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Al-Qaeda became popular after 9/11, became
right.
a brand, but it was not even being used as title for this group or these groups. And
well,
that's another interesting point, at least for the FBI.
Well, I don't think the title's so important. Obviously, Bin Laden, he didn't really like Al-Qaeda. He came up with some other long-winded names for his group that he wanted to use, and it was eventually he kind of got just had to acknowledge that the media is using around the world Al-Qaeda so much that
exactly.
they kind of said, okay,
US
we're Al-Qaeda.
Like
but that was pretty much after 9/11. But it's not really so much important as what these people are called as what they were doing and who they're working with, in my opinion. And you can see these two hijackers in particular have a long history going way back to the 1990s. I don't want to get too much into the Bosnian conflict, but there's
You're
good evidence that the U.S. was working hand-in-hand with Osama bin Laden and his supporters in Bosnia at that time. So these guys may well have had some sort of contacts with that going way back. And so that when Richard Clark in his interview says maybe they were trying to turn them, maybe they thought that they'd already turned them.
Exactly.
Or maybe they thought that... Well, these guys, we know them, we know all about them, these are great candidates to turn them. I don't know, we can just kind of speculate. Anyway, so to get back to the thread of what happened at the Malaysia summit and so forth, so what's really interesting is that it's sort of the bombshell out of this, all of the summit stuff, was the fact that Khalid Al-Midar had a visa to come to the United States. And actually, Nawaf al-Hazmi did too, but apparently they didn't know about that right at that point in time. And even as the summit was going on, there were efforts to prevent the FBI from knowing about that.
Before you go further, one question, because I don't have that information. Do you know where the visa was obtained, which embassy, where?
I'm pretty sure it was in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia,
okay,
if I remember.
Thank you.
Which is kind of a whole other story because that, at least historically, that had been used in the Afghan war to have the Mujahideen who were fighting in Afghanistan to get visas for them to come to the United States to be secretly trained and supported over there. So there's this. The more you dig into this stuff,
I have a State Department whistleblower. He hasn't been really that public and vocal, but he was actually in charge of the visa office in Jeddah mm-hmm. until, I believe, 2000-2001. And he also went to the commission, and he spoke a little bit about the stuff. He still hasn't gotten into the names, but he actually filed complaints about people who actually they knew that they were confirmed terrorist candidate lists. Because many of these CIA operatives worked through the embassy there in Jeddah, that every time they brought it up, they would be, you know, overridden by the CIA guys in the embassy over there in Jeddah. So
right.
that was why I was asking.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, you get these hijackers at the summit, and then the summit starts to break up, and these people start to be scattered to the four winds, and at that time, it would make sense that you would normally, the CIA would normally say, okay, FBI, you're interested in what's going on in the United States. We have information that one of these people at the summit, Khalid Al-Midar, he has a visa to come to the United States. He's almost certainly going to use it and probably be involved in some sort of attack there. They knew, for instance, he was involved in the embassy bombings and some other big attacks already. So... that does not happen. In fact, there is somebody who drafts a cable to be sent to the FBI saying just that, that he has this visa, and then a superior overrid him and basically said, you can't send that cable, you're not allowed to send it. He tried later, another week or two later, again told you're not allowed to send it. And then that same superior who told him not to send the cable turned around and sent a cable within the CIA telling everybody that the FBI had been told. So you can see right there, you can really see some duplicity. But it goes even further than just the FBI and the CIA not getting along. We have evidence, for instance, of the CIA branch in Thailand, because these guys, Al-Hazmi and Al-Midar, they went from the Malaysia meeting, they went to Thailand. The CIA branch in Malaysia kind of asked the Thai branch, what's going on with these guys? Do you know what happened to them there in Thailand? And the Thai branch said, we'll have to get back to you. We don't know what's going on. Whereas at that point, we know that the Thai branch was aware about this U.S. visa. So you have, even within the CIA, one branch is lying to the other branch about what they knew about these two particular hijackers. So it's not just FBI CIA turf battle kind of thing that's going on here. So after about a week after the summit, these two hijackers, they from Thailand, they get on a plane and they fly to the United States, and they immediately start living in San Diego. And Nawaf al-Hazmi, at least, he spends the next 2 years, basically, he never leaves the United States from that point on. He just lives openly in San Diego. He's got his number in the phone book and everything, and it would be so easy to find him. And Khalid Almodar, after a while, he leaves, and he actually, because, as I said, his father-in-law is the person who runs that Yemen hub, he actually goes back to the Yemen hub where his wife is, and he lives there for at least a month. And remember that that hub is so monitored, anybody coming and going, their picture is taken, there's bugs inside the house. I mean, there's so much that has not been revealed. How is it possible for Khalid Almodar to go back to that hub and live there for an entire month? He thinks that he's with fellow al-Qaeda people that he can trust. Would he not be talking about his time in the United States and what he's doing there and the whole 9/11 plot that he's a part of in this very building that is like the focus point of U.S. intelligence collection efforts? How is it possible that this 9/11 plot isn't discovered? And then you've got the fact that Khalid Almodar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, when they're living in San Diego, they're making calls back and forth to this hub all the time. And they're making other calls around the world. But, you know, we know at least that those calls are being recorded and monitored by the NSA. And how is it possible that some people don't say, hey, these two people are living in the United States and probably up to no good there?
And, Paul, what was the source of the funding that paid for their housing, paid for their expenses while they were living in San Diego?
Yeah, there are just so many threads to this. I think what happens is it's such a complicated story that people kind of lose the thread after a while because there's so many tangents and things. But it turns out that while those two hijackers were living in San Diego, there seems to have been a lot of money coming through the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C., into sort of the wife of a friend, and it seems to have peaked, or not peaked, but increased right when the hijackers got there, and a lot of people believe that money was actually helping to pay their living expenses. And there's a tremendous amount of other information about these hijackers having ties with the Saudis while they were there, and by Saudis, I don't just mean Saudi citizens, I mean Saudi intelligence agents. They went to the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles, hooked up with people there, some of whom apparently were, you know, very radical, militant-minded themselves who were working at that consulate. There was one particular guy named Omar al-Bayoumi who's a very important figure because he was living in San Diego, and he really seems to have been some sort of Saudi intelligence agent. He had no visible means of support, yet he had some ghost job with some Saudi government kind of related company and was being paid a tremendous amount of money for doing no work. And he had this habit of wandering around the mosques and places where Saudis who are living in the United States congregate. He'd have a video camera and a microphone on the camera, and he'd just be recording people willy-nilly and talking into the microphone, making his observations about all the things that he was recording. So everybody in town who was in that Saudi community basically knew that he was a Saudi government agent, and his job pretty much, what you would think that the Saudi government's always been very worried about radical Islamists who come along and want to overthrow the Saudi government. People like Osama bin Laden have always, you know, said all kinds of things about how they want to overthrow the Saudi royalty. So in sort of most towns, they would have somebody like Omar al-Bayoumi, who was keeping an eye to make sure that there weren't, you know, anti-Saudi government kind of insurrection going on amongst Saudi students who are scattered all over the world. So this guy, and when you go back to the Richard Clark interview, he puts forth a theory, and he says, you know, well, maybe when al-Hazmi and al-Madar were living in the United States, maybe the CIA kind of handed off surveillance of these two people to the Saudis. And so somebody like Omar al-Bayoumi running around with his video camera would be a likely person to be keeping close eyes on these guys. And he did have all kinds of ties with the, with these two people. He even they even lived at his place for a couple of weeks when they first got there. But I found that there's good evidence that al-Hazmi knew that that al-Bayoumi was a Saudi intelligence agency and disliked him and tried to stay away from him and was very wise to what this al-Bayoumi guy was doing. So if the CIA was trusting monitoring these two incredibly important al-Qaeda operatives to some guy who's just wandering around openly known as a Saudi intelligence agent walking around with a video camera all the time, I mean, that just doesn't seem to make any sense. Why would you do that? How could you learn any secrets about these people when you know you're so openly advertising yourself as a Saudi intelligence agent?
Well, and Paul, it begs the question about the role of Saudi Arabia and the royal family in funding al-Qaeda, supporting their efforts. We know that the bulk of the alleged hijackers were Saudi citizens, and yet the Bush administration gave Saudi Arabia a virtual complete pass in any investigation into these events. We went into Afghanistan to distract people from Saudi Arabia.
Well, you know, there's so many different threads in this story. And one thing that I've always been interested in is not only the possible whatever role United States government and other Western governments had in linkages with al-Qaeda and so forth, but also there were a lot of supporters of groups like al-Qaeda in the Muslim world. The people, even higher ups, billionaires in Saudi Arabia and other countries, were very kind of unideological, same thinking as Osama bin Laden. And so they would be supporting these groups with a lot of money and other kinds of support. And so you see all along that, you know, Osama bin Laden would never have been able to keep up, even though he had some money from his inheritance, from his big, rich family. It was estimated that al-Qaeda cost about $30 million to run every year. Not so much, you know, all these operatives running around, but sort of the training camps and there's a whole sort of network you have to have before you can even have any operatives taking part in everything. You have to be recruiting people and so forth. So it sort of had this big operation, cost $30 million a year. He would have run out of money pretty quickly. He had all these rich sheikhs living in the Middle East who were giving him a lot of money. So the question is, may have some of these Saudi contacts been aware of the 9/11 plot? May have they actually been funding some of the 9/11 hijackers? That's a very interesting story, but I think it's kind of a tangential story to the other story we're talking about today, which is, why doesn't the CIA do something about these guys? What do they know about these guys, and why don't they do something about them? One of the things about the Saudis is that that the CIA knew way back that the Saudi intelligence agency had been very compromised by their support for al-Qaeda. There was some people from another intelligence agency, I think the Jordanian intelligence agency, one day went into the headquarters of the Saudi intelligence agency, looked around, and they saw on the computers a lot of the people actually had pictures of bin Laden as their screensavers on their computer because they were big supporters of bin Laden.
Now, here is another contradiction, Paul, because all this time we keep hearing, both from the media but also from various supposed speeches by bin Laden, that he was actually a threat to the Saudi establishment, that he was absolutely feared and hated by the Saudis, and basically his number one goal was to basically get rid of the U.S. base from Saudi Arabia and also the kingdom. So how do they work together? I mean, we're looking at now two almost contradictory concepts here in terms of the relationship between bin Laden and the Saudis.
Well, it's so complicated, and it's a very parallel situation in Pakistan, where you see tremendous support from Pakistan, even from the Pakistan Intelligence Agency, to al-Qaeda and related groups. And at the same time, these groups are often attacking Pakistani government buildings and killing lots of people in Pakistan. And in Saudi Arabia, you have, it seems, even royal members, high-ranking members of the royal family are supporting bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and Osama bin Laden saying, down with the royal family, you know? So I think a lot of this kind of ends up being intrigues in politics, where, for instance, you might have one faction of the Saudi royal family who thinks, I would like to be king one day, and if I can use the fact that there are a huge number of people in Saudi Arabia who are supportive of bin Laden and bin Laden-type extremist Wahhabist religious beliefs, and kind of, you know, ally with that whole faction, then that could help me get to power. And the same kind of thing happening in Pakistan, where you have various factions playing off against each other and using using these militant groups as a way to get an edge. In fact, in Pakistan, there are times where one faction would actually hire people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi Youssef, his nephew, to, for instance, to kill. There was an attempt where those guys tried to kill Benazir Bhutto back in the 1990s. You know, so they're very much involved in the intrigues and the politics of these countries, which get very complicated, and people working sometimes at cross purposes or trying to kill each other and so
forth.
That
makes a lot of sense, especially with what you said with the divided kingdom as far as Saudi Arabia is concerned. And I think one of the dividers there is the attitude or the stand when it comes to Israel, because you have the old-timers, you have the top layer that actually behind the scenes, they do have good relationship with the, you know, with Israel. And then you have the segment there within the Saudi kingdom who are absolutely, you know, against the Zionism and what's happening in Israel. So that itself is one other example of how divided they are within their own kingdom.
Right. So to kind of keep trying to sort of make sure we stay on the focus of this al-Hazmi and al-Madar characters, you know, so Richard Clark, he's saying that these guys may have been monitored by Saudi Arabia, but to get back to the point that I made a minute ago, that the CIA was so leery of the support that a lot of people in the Saudi intelligence agency had for al-Qaeda, they had put out a notice a couple of years prior to all these events saying, basically, don't trust the Saudi intelligence agency about anything having to do with bin Laden. So how could they then turn around and say, oh, let's just leave these two, the first two al-Qaeda people we ever really knew who are living in the United States, we'll just trust the Saudi intelligence agency to keep an eye on them? I mean, that just doesn't make any sense to me. So I don't buy Richard Clark's theory there. So if you don't buy that theory, then that leaves a gaping hole. Who's looking after these two people when they're living for 2 years in the United States? Did they just drop the ball so badly that they just said, oh, I wonder whatever happened to those guys? You know, no one checked on them for 2 years. I don't buy that.
Neither do I.
Well, at this point, I'm going to pause here and conclude part one of our conversation with Paul Thompson, and this will make it easier for our listeners to listen to and absorb. And we will continue in part two, which will be released in short order after part one, so that you can get all this information and listen to them at your convenience.
Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.